This is the SF Productions Podcast Network. How I Got My Wife to Read Comics, Episode 307. Can a comic collector of over 25 years get his wife to read them? Will she let him keep them? Learn more in this podcast. Let's go to the comic book lounge with Mindy and Mark.
Bad man. To the Black Beauty. Return to the treehouse. Komoda. This is How I Got My Wife to Read Comics for Sunday, June 8th, 2014. I'm Mark.
And I'm Mindy. Just a reminder, you can go to SF Podcast Network to get the feed, other SF podcasts, and blogs. Or you can subscribe via iTunes where you can leave us a review.
You can email sfpodcastnetwork@gmail.com, like us at facebook.com/sfppn, follow us on Twitter at sfppn, or call us at 614-321-9737. That's 614-321-9SFP. Earth 2, number 24, by Taylor and Scott. Despite the cover, the story has little to do with the Beguiler. It does start with him, her.
Yeah, because later on, I think they refer to the Beguiler as her.
Yeah, and he or she is torturing Flash of Earth 2, but we then quickly cut back to Green Lantern of Earth 2 and the team in the aftermath of the nuclear blast that Batman set off. So they follow these few surviving parademons to find Flash, and then meanwhile, Thomas Wayne blames Val for not stepping in and stopping the army, which clearly he could have if he had wanted to. But then Jimmy dresses down Thomas.
And he knows who Thomas is.
Right.
You know, he addresses him by name. It's not Batman, it's Thomas.
And I love the line, "You and I are going to have a serious talk about your attitude."
Yeah. And Jimmy saying he would have been Robin.
Yeah. But then we cut back to GL, who's fighting the parademons while Hawkgirl finds and saves Flash. Then back to Jimmy, who gives Val a pep talk. He then rips off his hoodie to show the S emblem beneath. It almost seems like Val suddenly aged, because he seemed more like a kid, and now he seems like an adult.
I'm not sure if it was a sudden thing. I thought he was like, maybe the sun was gradually making him get older because, you know, he had not been exposed to the sun.
Okay.
And so now the sun is aging him and it, you know, he was a little bit older in each one until finally he looked more like a old teen, I would say, rather than an adult. But
I thought it was a decent issue. It had less fighting than normal and more character-based things going on, so I appreciated that. I really love the interplay between Jimmy and Thomas.
Yes. Well, even between Jimmy and Val, you know, he's explaining that Thomas isn't really angry because of Val. He's just angry.
Right.
You know, Jimmy seems to be, even though he's supposed to be this computer-y person, seems to be more in touch with people than other
he's
characters.
He's more empathetic.
Yes.
Batman 66 meets the Green Hornet number 1 by DC and Dynamite by Smith, Garman, and Templeton. This is a cross-publisher crossover. It's also a sequel to the TV episode of Batman, the Adam West series, where Green Hornet guest starred. Kevin Smith is the co-writer of this. Now, Green Hornet was created for radio in 1936. He's Britt Reed, publisher of the Daily Sentinel, but at night he's a vigilante who presents himself as a criminal so he can infiltrate the underworld. And he wears this long green overcoat, a fedora, and a mask.
So in a way, he sort of like matches Malone.
Kinda. Yeah, same concept. He's the descendant of the Lone Ranger, John Reed. And the reason for that is this same Detroit radio station, WXYZ, created both Lone Ranger and the Green Hornet. His aide, Kato, is a Japanese martial artist, although during World War II, I think he was made Filipino. They drive around the Black Beauty, this bulletproof, tricked-out car. He had two movie serials in the 1940s, and of course he had the TV series from 66 to 67, produced by the same people that produced Batman, with Van Williams as Hornet and Bruce Lee as Kato. And of course, Bruce Lee was hugely popular and became this megastar in Asia, especially in the 70s, to the point where the show was marketed in Hong Kong as The Kato Show. Of course, there was the terrible 2011 film with Seth Rogen as Green Hornet.
Well, can you say it was terrible if you never saw it?
I did see it.
Oh, did you?
I did see it.
I didn't.
Of course, there were comics from several publishers, Holyoke in 1940, Harvey from 40 to 47, Dell in 53, Gold Key in 67 in association with the TV series. Now Comics had the rights from 89 to 95, and Dynamite Comics have had the rights since 2009. Anyways, in the story, Bruce goes along on this train that's transporting priceless fossils to Hornet City, which I believe is New York, but they never say, and I actually looked up on the net to see, is there an actual name to Green Hornet City? And I couldn't find anything.
Interesting.
So I think they just assume it's New York. Bruce is on the museum board, of course, and that's his excuse to be there. Brett and Kato are on the train as well.
Now, see, this brings up a point with me.
Yeah.
Bruce is on the train as a member of the board, but also he has assured Commissioner Gordon as Batman.
Yes.
Yet he didn't bring his outfit with him. We'll come to that later, I'm sure, but that just annoyed me.
The train is stopped by some sort of glue, and I love the line from Kato. Well, what kind of glue is more powerful than a locomotive?
Yes.
And there's a quick cut to Dick Grayson, who's out on a date. Bruce calls him in. Dick flies in on the Batcopter and then hands Bruce a briefcase with the Batman outfit in it. But you're right. Why didn't he just bring it himself in the first place? But of course, the villain in all this is Colonel, now General Gum, who is played by Roger C. Carmel in the original series. He now has gum welded permanently to his face.
Or glue.
Well, yeah. Maybe it was an issue with getting the rights to the Roger C. Carmel face. Or the guy just couldn't draw him.
Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, it seems to me that there shouldn't be a problem with, you could just make him look like somebody else if you wanted to.
I suppose. There's various battles on the train, and then in the cliffhanger, our four heroes are literally stuck on top of the train, which is about to go into a tunnel. Dun, 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 dun. Mm-hmm. I thought the artwork was excellent overall. I thought they really captured all the characters, with maybe the exception of Colonel Gum. Tiny Titans Return to the Treehouse, number one by Balthazar and Franco.
It's nice to see this back.
Absolutely. This kid-friendly title is back in miniseries form. I love how it begins with a reference to the Superman Family Adventures title, because Superboy and Supergirl and Krypto are coming back and just basically say, oh, can't wait till we tell the kids what we did and all this.
Yeah.
Beast Boy is mooning over Terra. And then the Brainiac Club members, Brainiac 5 and Simon, are working on their merit badge, which involves shrinking the treehouse. Unfortunately, Beast Boy, Terra, and Raven are inside at the time. The kids go to the Bat Cave for help, and Robin uses the Bat GPS to try to track them down.
Well, it's the kids who weren't in the treehouse at the time.
Yes.
And who come back and discover that the treehouse is missing. Yes.
During this, they end up running into Swamp Thing, Solomon Grundy, and Metamorpho in various points. And finally, Supergirl finds the treehouse with her X-ray vision. Raven uses a spell in order to break the kids out, but the treehouse is still in the bottle, which, of course, that's what you do when you shrink one of the cities for the Brainiac Club. You put it in a bottle.
Yes.
Unfortunately, Brainiac arrives and takes the treehouse away. Alfred helps out and builds them a new treehouse, but they'll have to get used to the bats, of course.
Of course.
This is a really cute title, and as you said, it's great to see this return. It's too bad it's just a miniseries.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, they might be able to stretch it out.
Yeah.
Get it renewed again. They probably like having it as a miniseries, because then they don't have to commit.
True.
And then it can just keep coming back as more miniseries.
Right. And of course, the same team is currently doing the Action Cat series for Aw Yeah, and they're also doing some projects for Dark Horse at this point. Miracle Man number 7 from Marvel by the original writer, Davis and Austin. And when they say original writer, they mean Alan Moore, who would not give them the rights to use his name.
Yes. Because, I love that.
Because Alan Moore is just...
cranky.
Cranky, cranky man. This character was in legal limbo for decades. It's a British title, which started as essentially Captain Marvel. Virtually the same concept. The only difference was that instead of saying Shazam, he would say Komoda, which is atomic backwards.
Mm-hmm.
They unfortunately named the character Marvel Man, and this is before Marvel became a real publisher. They were Atlas Comics at the time this was coming out. Between using Captain Marvel as more than just an inspiration, but pretty much a ripoff, and using the name Marvel Man as the character, it's a legal landmine for anybody to touch it. Marvel finally worked it out in this past year after decades in the courts. They said, okay, we're going to buy up the rights and we're going to name the character Miracle Man and then we're fine.
Yes.
Alan Moore made this character relevant in the 1980s.
Which is, that, and that's when Marvel decided, oh, we're going to go after it, right?
Right. That's when it started. Basically, he took this goofy character and made him serious and scary. Miracle Man was a huge influence in 80s and 90s comics. It's all brooding. There's violence. There's a lot more character-based things going on. It's very psychological. So the whole story so far has been about how to provide a realistic explanation of the character.
Right.
You're reestablishing this character from the 50s, and now you're making him relevant, and you're saying, okay, how does all this work when it was just a goofy comic for kids at the time? This is kind of the type of thing that Geoff Johns does with characters, of taking goofy concepts and making them more relevant. So this issue actually shows how arch-villain slash creator of Miracle Man, Gargunza, he actually uses a Captain Marvel comic as inspiration. They don't actually say Captain Marvel, but he finds, and they show a picture of what is clearly a Captain Marvel comic, and he uses that as inspiration when he creates this creature, which involves this alien
tech and negative space,
yeah,
and subconscious suggestion.
Right.
And
but he's doing all this because he wants to get the unborn baby of Marvel Man, so, and he can become immortal.
Well, because he couldn't do this whole process on himself.
Right, because he's too old.
Because he's too old. So if he can transfer his consciousness into the baby,
right,
then he can do it to himself and never die.
Exactly. Want to note that before you buy this, please keep this in mind. Only half of each issue is the 1980s story. The rest of the issue are artwork and pinups, and generally we've seen an old Miracle Man story from the 50s, which frankly looks like the worst independent comics. I mean, it's...
yeah.
It looks like a 14-year-old did it. It's just terrible. And so far, we've only seen reprints of the 80s stories. We'll eventually get new stories.
I wouldn't call them new necessarily. They're just unpublished because they were written back then, but were never published then.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
By Neil Gaiman.
Yes.
Right. But I think there's eventually going to be new stories that Neil is going to write. That's the impression I've gotten.
Well, I know there were a number of issues that he wrote back then that they weren't able to publish because of the rights issues.
Yeah. You may want to wait for the trade, I guess, is the moral of the story here.
Yeah, anymore, that's what I'm saying for a lot of things. You may want to wait for the trade.
Yeah. All right, before we get out of here, it's time to play America's fastest growing new game show.
Guess who's on the cover of Entertainment Weekly? Are you ready, Mark?
I'm ready.
Okay, I'm pressing the button.
TV related?
Yes.
Is it one show?
Yes.
Okay, one person on the cover?
No.
Two?
Yes.
Man and a woman?
Yes.
Okay, so is it a new show?
No.
All right. Is it a show on one of... is it on ABC?
No.
NBC?
No.
CBS?
No.
Fox?
No.
CW?
No.
Cable?
Yes.
Is it pay cable?
Yes.
Okay. So it's HBO?
No.
Showtime?
Yes.
Man and Woman, show on Showtime, and it's an existing series.
Yes.
Okay. Is it a genre related?
No.
Is it a drama?
Yes.
Okay. Is it historic?
Yes.
Okay. And it's on Showtime. Showtime. And this is the part I don't know a lot of stuff that's on Showtime.
This is what we get for not having cable.
I guess. Showtime. Are they under 30?
No.
Under 40?
Yes.
Okay. And it's kind of genre related?
Well, it was more the historical aspect I was thinking of when I was hemming and hawing.
Okay.
You know, it's like, well, you know, depends on if you call 20th century show genre or not.
Okay, so is it that Masters of Sex?
It is. You got that with 4 seconds left. I won't make you guess who the two people are because you haven't a clue, yes.
Nope.
But you did get the TV show. It's basically it's a summer TV issue.
Oh, okay.
Which makes sense since last week was the summer movie issue.
Right. All right. Want to remind you to go to sfpodcastnetwork.com to get the feed, other SF podcasts and blogs, including our From the Pop Culture Bunker video podcast. You can subscribe via iTunes, and please leave us a review.
You can email sfpodcastnetwork@gmail.com, like us at facebook.com/sfppn, follow us on Twitter at sfppn, or call us at 614-321-9737. That's 614-321-9SFP.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.